Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, standing there by...
Kia ora, everyone. I'm here today with Kristen Warner. Kia ora, Kristen.
Hi, hello.
Thank you for coming in. Kristen is a writer, journalist, and musician. She's worked as a television researcher and for newspapers and magazines. She writes poetry, and I want to put this in there, won a number of awards in Auckland Library's National Poetry Day competitions. She has now published a novel, The Sound of Breaking Glass, which is bringing her new readers as well as critical acclaim. I read the book over one weekend, a very powerful story, and I found Kristen to be an author, which I might not have had this intuition from the poetry, but as a novelist, an author who does not pull any punches. Would you like to tell us a little about the book before we start digging in for listeners who haven't read it yet, Kristen?
Thank you. It's good to be here. I wrote a book called The Sound of Breaking Glass, because it is about a woman at shattering point. It is also historically referenced to the events of Nazi Germany and the breaking of a culture, the breaking of lives, and that physical sound of breaking glass, which references the events of the night of broken glass, Kristallnacht. So that was the biggest sense what the book's about. It's also about Auckland. It's about being a young mother and a working mother. It's about sexual politics. It's about concern about the environment and women's politics. And it's about reality television and all sorts of other things.
And it's told in first person.
It is.
By the woman that you've described. However, this is an interesting question. We could start here, talking about how you came to write the book and how much that narrator is you, which is what everybody always thinks when they read a novel. We know the tendency is immediately to think autobiographical.
Well, I think I was playing around with that idea. I've always been interested in... Well, I didn't... wasn't able to write the conventional novel. Clearly, I came to start this because I was in a writer's group with a couple of other women, and I was pretty much a blocked writer and struggling. You know, every now and again I'd write something and it'd do very well, and then my critical voice would shut me down again. And so my friend Catherine Delahunty, who, this was before she was in Parliament, she said, right, we're going to deal with this. And she did this sort of role play with me, putting my critical voice in a chair and getting me to talk to it, and hearing what it had to say. And so I just started writing that down. And to me, it's very interesting moving in and out of that idea of what's true and what's made up and what's a conventional novel and what's not a conventional novel but works as one.
And how sometimes truth, this is a thing that comes up often when you talk about fiction, is how fiction can present a truth which is truer than people's memories of facts which have occurred or people's knowledge of the facts, because it can present a different kind of truth, which is an emotional truth or a historical trend truth, rather than we define the difference between fiction and nonfiction as, you know, nonfiction really happened.
It's made up.
Yeah, it's
made up.
And yet the truth that would come out of fiction is usually not made up at all. It's actually...
True. I keep thinking of D.H. Lawrence and the merciless way he used his coal mining father and background in his books. And I think, well, D.H. Lawrence did it. Why shouldn't I?
Yeah, there's certainly...
You know, it's always like that. You write what you know, you write what you can. I just went to Lit Crawl in Wellington and listened to a wonderful young Irish author called Rod Doyle, and he said, well, I'm no good at making things up, so I just, you know, put myself in there. So someone in the audience said to him afterwards, so have you had treatment for your alcoholism? And we were just like stunned. Didn't she get it that this was a character?
Yeah.
This wasn't actually him.
Yeah, well, or as Flaubert would say, the Madame Bovary, c'est moi, the characters c'est are moi. All you, but or not necessarily in
right.
the factual side of what you
that's
did with
right.
your life. The CV might not be the same,
that's
but there will
right.
be some inner perception or insight. This is how writers, isn't that right? They're a bit scavengers. You go around and pick from here and there.
Oh, well, I am. Yeah. I don't know. I've picked from here and there and then done something else with it. And then you've got to transform it. You can't just dump your life into a book or your family into a book.
Yeah. Well, they say, when you were saying this is not a conventional novel, it begs the question, are there conventional novels anymore? I mean, there are.
Yes.
I suppose if you mean conventional by the sense of the novel that grew out of the 1800s and told a story, the very, very early, you learn in lit classes that the very early fiction was always written as if it was truth, because people were used to reading true stories. So if you read Moll Flanders, it's presented as if this is the true story. It's not presented as a novel because people's concept of people's worldview didn't include that of reading an entire made-up story. And the novel has to change to be able to survive. Or as people point out, it's going to become like the symphony that a few people to listen to. So the meta novel, the layered novel, which is something that. Just let you, all you people know out there, I'm closing in on the sound of breaking glass when I start talking about the layers. So, that was so interesting in the sense that the book is continually offering a number of layers and a number of intuitions in the same moment of action.
Yes.
And so that begs the question again, lots of questions begged by this book, about your family history and the stories that your family stories and how much they played in that layering and where they sit in that layering. Were they a starting point? Were they?
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, yes, there's definitely some of my family stories in there and some of my family story. There's three different time strands, if you like, going on. There's the 1930s and 40s, there's the 1970s, and there's the 1990s. And I had to make those be accurate, for the sake of the novel. I didn't want anyone dropping out. my family history that I did want to write about was the inheritance of the experience of a parent who survived the Holocaust. So I had to show something of the big parental story, but I did not want to fall into telling the story of the survivor. So I've had to create all sorts of structures that show how it is, and some of it's true and some of it's not. For instance, my father used to return to the story about his uncle, and I have told that in the book, but there is just one line which makes you wonder how true any of it is, because the main character says, I wondered how he knew all this. How did he know if this uncle was sent to Auschwitz? That was the end of it. No one heard of him again. So how did he know? It was always those sort of circular, repetitive, apocryphal stories. Whether they're true or not, you don't know. There's definitely some of my, and I'm grateful. I acknowledge my family for they didn't give permission. I just took them and used them. Stories like that. My father came from Berlin. But the father in the book has actually a different path from my father, who arrived before the war. And this father in the book tells a different story. My mother died when I was 15, and that's in the book. But I didn't want to, I wanted to use events that showed that nothing is simple. Everything is interrelated.
Interrelated, and also I really admired in the book the nuance. So everything is interrelated. Everything is also never so simple and never one-dimensional. So it contains many different aspects and different strands. And I thought even the discussion about surviving trauma, which is very important, one of the important themes in the book, you did an exceptional job of digging under the surface buzzwords, because trauma is a very topical topic today, isn't it?
Yeah.
What was that? Yes. Yeah, writing about trauma like that was...
Well, it's it's kind of familiar to me because it is my background. And, you know, having had a father who woke up screaming and from his nightmares, we all knew to be very careful when Dad was asleep, you know, not to give him a fright. And he did shout all through his life. And when he was dying, he was talking in German about his mother. And, you know, you don't get over that kind of grief and trauma. And it's not possible for them. So I wanted to write about the fact that it's not possible and that children actually carry out the emotional work of their parents that is transferred to them to finish. I knew a lot more about people who weren't like my father through the members of my second generation group. I found myself finally in a group of people whose parents were also survivors of the Holocaust. And I knew from their stories that, and from my reading and my research, that survivors were dismantled. You know, their whole psyche is dismantled. Nothing is what it seems in a place of such terror and horror. You know, your whole human assemblage gets dismantled. So the book is very much about being dismantled, you know, the subconscious rising and falling, both for the father and for the daughter. So, you know, it's true and it's my experience and I understand it, but it's also extended into experiences that I didn't have. Mm.
That's so interesting, that idea of the being taken apart by trauma and how the responsibility passes on to a next generation to finish putting things back together in some way. That's so interesting. It's very similar to a thing about, it has something to do with writing stories in the sense that that's writing stories is a way of making sense of things, and putting things back together in some way that rewards, because that's what we do want out of life, isn't it? That we all would like things to be rewarded.
Oh, yes. And you're smiling as you say that because, you know, it's a pleasure. It can't be awful reading. So, you know, you'd also have to get pleasure out of it, even if it's that, you know, hugely being moved. But humor is one of the ways we survive everything. And Jewish humour is a survival mechanism too. Mm. So I grew up with a lot of that, you know, great storytellers, great sense of humour. People still try and tell my father's jokes. Mm-hmm. And my son recorded quite a lot of them and sold them to Hollywood producers. And, yeah, there's humour in the book as well.
Humour in stories is, I can't remember who said this, but I remember being so impressed by it, that it's a particular strength of the Jewish people because it's a portable art.
Yeah.
Because because of the diaspora and not owning property and being constantly moved, thrown out of one country, admitted to another, and then thrown out of that country, there was this portable art that you could take with you, which was your roots, which could fall into this humor and stories, with stories often humorous or bitter, but humor and bitter. I like that point that you make about feel good, what makes you feel good when you're reading something, because I often try to make this point to people when people say, what's a book I'll enjoy? And people are surprised because I'll name a dark book.
Yes.
But that's what I enjoy because it can be thought-provoking in some way that at the end I find that I'm enjoying it. It doesn't have to do with it. It has to name pleasant. It has to describe pleasant situations. Isn't that right? I'm sure that part of the writing of the book for you when you took on the voice of the narrator was the pleasure of conveying the many layers of what was happening to her, even though sometimes they're very, very awful, particularly thinking of the encounter with Karate Man.
He's a beast, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's the archetypal predator.
He is. There are many archetypal figures in this book.
It's all archetypes.
Yeah. And I love the way they are given names, because I actually do that in my own life as well. You know, you forget the Christian name. It's all about that man is associated with. So he was the man at the beach, and there was the man who did this, the man. But anyway, so what I wanted to ask was some of those scenes that you had to write about this narrator and her coming of age and some of the brutal and more ugly things that she encounters, that must have been quite harrowing. Was that hard to write?
I certainly did not enjoy writing that. It makes me cringe. I certainly don't like reading them. But my women friends tell me, you got that right.
Yes.
Yes, that's what they were like. And, yeah, my, you know, they certainly tell me that they've all had one of those in their lives. So, yeah, I must have got it right because I did not enjoy it, though. It's hard to write that stuff.
Well, it takes some courage. I'll put that, my compliments.
Thank you.
There is a lot of courage. When I put down the book and I sat there on my couch and thought, and one of the things that kept coming to me was the many different ways in which courage was a word was applied to this book. So there's the courage of the people, characters in the book, but also your courage in writing some of these
Thank you for that. Thank you for acknowledging that. It has been really hard to write. It's not, you know, I didn't take on something easy. I took on something almost superhuman. That's the actual theme of it, you know, that what you're up against is memorializing the Holocaust. It's so much bigger than any one person or any one idea or any one thing. And yet you've inherited it. You have to carry it round. You have to be responsible for it, you know. There's a lot of naming that goes on after dead relatives and, you know, the people that were lost, and somehow you have to carry the meaning into the next generation. And so, yes, it's very much bigger and impossible. It's like the fairy tale of, you know, climbing up the glass mountain. You're always going to slip down. It's so much bigger than you are.
And there's also the slippery thing of the worrying about, I don't know how much you had to worry about this, your reader's possible sensitivities.
I did, thank you. I wanted to say that, and I kind of got a bit lost thinking about the largeness of this thing.
Yeah.
Definitely, first of all, Jewish readers. Were they going to offend them? Because I'm not actually Jewish. My father was, but I'm not. And certainly, I have absolutely no, you know, I didn't do it lightly. I'm very, very careful about acknowledging the testimony and tremendous survival of you know, people who came out of those times. Was I going to offend modern Jewish readers? Was I going to, you know, how would people that I work with in television feel about the way I portrayed them?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well,
have you heard from them?
No, but, you know, those who were there say, yeah, you did that well, you know. And they tell me who they think it is. And I go, oh, I hadn't thought of him.
There's
always one of them.
That's right. There is, but there's also no note at the beginning of the book about if, you know, these characters do not correspond. So I think you must have felt pretty safe. You know, the famous, there's no real life correspondence between my characters.
Well, and didn't bother with that. Yeah. Who could tell? If they want to put their hand up to be that person.
You're always happy to meet them. Come and bring you up.
No, they're happy to whatever shit comes their way, you know.
Have you got a little piece of one of those scenes in the television studio perhaps you could read?
Studio.
Or in general, that part of the narrator's life, which for Aucklanders, and I think since we are Community Radio Auckland.
I think I did mark a passage. I wasn't sure where we'd hit.
Well, we can hit more than just this, but
yes.
That is a way of starting in to show some of your wicked humor.
Oh, well, keep talking while I find one. Plastic. Oh, I think it was around plastic.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no, here we go. Where is he? Where he says he wants a... Okay, so she's having a morning coffee with the producer, her producer, and she says... She thinks of him. I don't know if he even gets a name here. She's got a character, her inner critic, which seems to be looming larger than life. And her producer, she just calls Fat Controller. His cynicism is turning bad-tempered, but I can't stop myself. They must be mad. The rest of the world stopped burning rubbish. Whatever they say about high temperatures and state-of-the-art, it's miles more deadly than dumping. What about the CO2 emissions, the dioxins, the chemical pollution? She's just thinking here. Ash containing heavy metals and unburnt chemicals and whole new chemicals. They've still got to dump somewhere. Well, then it's lucky we've got our foot in the door already. Lena wants to see a proposal. The Birch, he's clearly on top of his game, and yet he's petulant as if it's up to me to come up with a solution. I don't trust any of them. Shall I go on?
Yes, please.
I notice he's saying, ow, as if, I want to be part of it, now's my chance. There's something else I want to run past you. Better impress me, his body language says. I can hear Ted warning me, make sure it's your idea. You should own it. How about being inside on an environmental action, but this one's being planned by a group of well-known women and not your usual greenie activists? Women against surplus plastic. We go inside the wasp's nest. I've heard they're seriously up to some kind of protest over recycling. I think I could convince them to let me follow the action. I can see the stingers out now. He pokes one finger at me. It would have to have drama. He thinks for a minute, smirking. Give me cleavage and a catfight and it's all yours. He gulps coffee, especially if that rock star's involved. How does he know about her already? He finishes his cup and stands. Give me something on paper. I don't know if I captured that. We just jumped right into it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was... there's a lot in the book also about power and power imbalances, and she's, that captured very well... for me, who's read the book, but I'm happy to fill in our listeners. So she's actually moving her way up in this world of television, hoping to, while retaining her integrity and doing a good job and being creative. And she's pretty, what would be the word? She's pretty hopeful that she can. She comes up against some strong barriers, as we know women do, possibly. More, I think in the 90s, it was probably just about hitting the zeitgeist of this, where you got trapped. And it doesn't mention, for example, in those days, all the women there would have had to be wearing high heels as compared to now when,
only some women, new feminists wear them. Makes me laugh.
Yeah.
I know I never wore high heels. And, probably the executive women did stomp around in them.
Oh, yeah.
They certainly did.
Could not get ahead if you were not wearing high heels. It showed you off to be a blue stocking, intellectual. Possibly there would have been some questioning about whether or not she shaved her legs after that. I think we've moved, luckily, seem to have moved somewhat beyond worrying just about women's legs, but we definitely are still finding ourselves up against the man who wants the catfights and cleavage, even if they might not know to, might not be using that, might know enough not to use that particular language. So how do you feel about when you wrote this and you said it in the 90s? Was that something you were aware of as you were writing it? Oh, no, actually, that hadn't happened yet. Oh, no, this is...
Oh, yes, it was quite confusing and difficult to edit because I might have started and stopped and started and stopped as I... got another consuming media job and, my children needed looking after and I lost my way and lost faith, lost hope and had no support at all writing this book. Oh, no, that's not quite true. I did have a mentorship through the Society of Authors at a very early stage where she just used to say, oh, that's interesting, keep writing. But after that, I stopped and started a lot. And so I just wrote as if I didn't care whether it was a book or not and what was going to happen to it. And then I had to go back and say, heck, there wasn't any breakfast television.
Oh, yes, the double check on the,
my
timeline.
Goodness,
yeah.
That was really hard because you want to behave as if there's cameras there like we expect them today. Everything's on camera. It wasn't in the 90s. It was really laborious. Outside broadcast vans or, radio used to be put down the telephone or, they'd go back to the studio with the big, big cameras. And I was around when digital cameras first came in. It was really hard editing this. And so hats off to Mary McCallum and making sure that things were accurate for the 90s.
So it would have been a lot of Googling back.
a lot of it isn't even there. I was making contact with all the people I knew and who were 90s journalists and working in radio and television, you know, people like Rick Carlion and people I didn't know, but they kind of knew of me, and they'd say, oh, I don't remember, and then there'd be one or two who just remembered everything. It's a lot of time spent checking that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's just not there.
In terms of the book being something which brought you back to an earlier time, did you also feel how you had grown since the time when you were living that? Yeah. Did you feel a sort of an inward voyage that you had taken? Were you...
Oh, yes, life goes on. I mean, you know, it might have taken a long time to write, but it also took a long time to get published. And
how was that trip to publishing?
Oh, painful. Painful. You know, constant rejection. So, in the meantime, I just forgot about it and let it go, and every now and again I'd send it out again and stop talking about it. Didn't want to look like such a failure to my friends and family. And so it was a long time, and looking back at that time, yes, it's really another lifetime. And it was the 90s. It's not now.
It's not now, no, but it's certainly presented with a vivid feel to it that I never felt like I was traveling, time traveling.
Oh, gosh.
I felt very contemporary.
Oh, good, because the issues that I could see then and wanted to write about have suddenly come into sharp relief.
They absolutely,
you know,
have.
Environmental issues. The group of women is called Women Against Surplus Plastic. Nothing is more urgent today. Well, we could see it coming, and the same people who scoffed and minimised and, you know, made fun of us as concerned people or journalists are now putting it on their magazine covers.
Yeah.
You know, it's outrageous how the deniers have managed to prevail for the past 20 years. And, you know, it was the beginning of recycling in the 90s. Well, we've made a bad job of it. You know, people say, oh, it's so topical with the Me Too movement.
Oh, I was just going to bring that up. I was just going to say another. The other big thing besides the warning about the damage we're doing to the environment is that, you know, in the 90s, I can remember talking about sexual harassment and how it was part of that feminists don't have a sense of humor. Well, I was just making a joke, and how far we've come since then with the Me Too movement, which has made that discussion in the book very topical.
Very
discussion is the wrong word. That plot development,
yeah,
which is another one of the more harrowing plot developments. I wonder, we've got just about 2 minutes. Is there a short piece that you could find to read that is more about the narrator's maybe family relationships as opposed to work relationships?
Yes, I'm sure there is. Whoa, I'm so sorry. Here we go. About the grandmother. She's
wonderful.
Very interested in the grandmother because it's a surprise to this protagonist that there is such a thing as a grandmother. It's a real surprise. My bare feet are aching on the cold grass. There may even have been a light frost overnight. I've left a paper hanky in a pocket and have to shake the clothes. Torn tissue snows the grass. How cold would my feet be in snow, on ice? How long would I have lasted without shoes? If I had to walk until my feet were frostbitten and my toes went black and were just stumps and my legs were swollen and I hadn't eaten for days, weeks, months, but my will to live was still driving me, so I dropped down and drank from puddles and the villagers gave nothing. We slept on the ground, not even pigsties. It was minus 10, minus 20, no proper clothes. We only stopped walking when the guards were tired so they could eat. I was not really aware of being human anymore yet I still saw the sunset. I drew consolation from the beauty of the sky, a bird, the memory of my beloved mother's face.
Oh, so there you go. That's another example of the power of the writing in this book, Kirsten. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, our time is up. We've got 10 seconds left to say thank you so much and to tell everybody out there, get a hold of this book and read it. You will not be disappointed. The Sound of Breaking Glass.
Thank you.
This program was brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz
and catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond.